Rationally Speaking is a presentation of New York City Skeptics, dedicated to promoting critical thinking, skeptical inquiry, and science education. For more information, please visit us at nycskeptics.org.
Welcome to Rationally Speaking, the podcast where we explore the borderlands between reason and nonsense. I am your host, Massimo Piliucci, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Julia Galef. Julia, what's our topic today?
Massimo, today we have a guest joining us all the way from Melbourne, Australia. Cordelia Fine is an academic psychologist at the University of Melbourne and the recent author of the book Delusions of Gender, The Real Science Behind Sex Differences. The book examines common beliefs about innate differences in the way men and women think, especially differences in which women are held to have more empathetic minds and men have more systematic minds, which in turn is used to explain why we find more men than women in fields like math and science and engineering. So the book goes through all of the research that allegedly shows these hardwired differences from developmental psychology, social psychology, and neuroscience, and concludes that the vast majority of it is either poorly conducted or poorly interpreted or simply ambiguous enough that we should really be much less certain than we seem to be about whether these differences are in fact innate. Cordelia, welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me on the program.
Cordelia, I read your book actually at the suggestion of a previous guest of Rationally Speaking, Carol Tavares, who wrote Mistakes Were Made But Not By Me, which was a delightful book in and of itself. And when she was here actually in our studio, at the time she was reading your book and she gave such glowing reviews that I said, well, I got to read this thing. Now, would you mind, however, for those of us that have not read the book, sort of summarizing the most important points that you're trying to make throughout?
Well, really, I think Julia's already made a rather nice summary of the book, which is that we shouldn't be closing the scientific door on the idea that there's a possibility of much greater equality in society than we have now. So what I really do in the book is it falls into three parts. And I suppose at the core of the book is this idea that we need to turn to biology as fallback. So we have this very egalitarian society. We're trying very hard to rear gender-neutral children, and yet, you know, look around us, there's still this extraordinary amount of gender inequality, and because we look to society and we can't see answers to that, we sort of look inside the head instead, we look to the brain. So in the first part of the book, I take a closer look at the idea that we're sort of functioning in a gender-equal society, and I look at the subtle and not-so-subtle ways in which gender stereotypes influence our own behaviour, how we perceive others and so on and so forth. In the last part of the book, I look at this idea of the failure of gender-neutral parenting and take a close look at why what we know from developmental psychology really suggests that this is a very naive idea that we are achieving any such thing, that such thing is even possible. And then at the core of the book is to look at the supposedly very compelling evidence that there are sort of hardwired predispositions that differ between the sexes. And so what I did was I looked at what is seen as being sort of the strongest lines of evidence for that kind of idea. So looking at fetal testosterone, its sex differences in the brain, its data from monkeys, its data from newborns. But what is probably worth just adding is the book that I ended up writing is actually a rather different book to the one that I originally intended to write. So I have noticed that there's a tendency, some people assume that I sort of set out with this political agenda to disprove anything that might suggest that there are innate differences between the sexes. This is actually not the case. What happened was that I'm a parent, and I was reading a parenting book that suggested that, you know, boys and girls have different brains, and we should therefore educate them and parent them in different ways as a result. And I sort of found this quite interesting, but, you know, being an academic and having access to you know, journal articles and so on, I looked up one of the claims about the differences between boys and girls' brains, and I was really shocked at this disconnection between what was being claimed in the text. and what the actual neuroimaging study showed. And because at the time I was involved in a project on neuroethics, which was interested in, well, how is this new neuroimaging technology changing our conception of ourselves, and should we, you know, what are the ethical implications of that? I thought, gosh, you know, I wonder how this sort of popular, how this, you know, this new data about sex differences in the brain is being popularized. And so I started to look at other popular books about gender differences, and I saw things that are even worse, and it's just this horrible mangling of the data. And so what I wanted to do was really write a book about the misrepresentation in the popularization of the literature that also seems to be ignoring very interesting evidence in social psychology showing how our minds are influenced by gender stereotypes and so on and so forth, and environmental cues. So when I came to look at and when I look at my initial book proposal, there's nothing there about critiquing the scientific literature itself. It's mostly about how it's been popularized. But when I came to the scientific literature myself, I was sort of in this strange place where nothing seemed to quite add up. So there were all these inconsistencies. There are these assumptions that were sort of just perpetuated and never tested. There are these methodologies which seem to be rather poor. And I ended up having to get an extension on the book, and the book ended up being a very different book to the one that I initially intended to write, because I was surprised by how problematic I found the scientific
literature. So let me ask you about specific aspect of this problem, which is actually you alluded to a minute ago, which is so many parents talk about sort of the anecdotal evidence that, well, you know, we really tried hard to raise our kids in a gender-neutral way, and yet, guess what? You know, my daughter started doing things that are girlish, and my boy started doing things that are boyish, and there really seems to be nothing that I could do about it. Therefore, as you pointed out a minute ago, sort of the default explanation then for this outcome, despite the best attempts on the parents, is, well, there must be something biologically unchangeable going on in there. You point out in the book there, however, that there are in fact other explanations, that the situation is more complicated than that, right?
For a number of reasons, and I should just say this notion of biology as fallback is a lovely phrase that's coined by a sociologist called Emily Kane, who interviewed a lot of parents of preschoolers and found that this was a very common theme, particularly amongst her sort of upper middle class parents who were very sort of egalitarianly minded, and yet despite what they saw their best of it, you know, the sort of gendered behaviour was being manifested in their children. And I have to say that there's this standard joke in amongst commentators in this debate that, you know, the people who think that gender differences are socialized by parents are, you know, there's a name for them, they're called childless. Right. So, you know, when I had my own children, I didn't realise just what an incredible asset they would be to me in commentating on this debate, because I get this feeling that if I didn't have children myself, then it didn't matter how many scientific articles I'd read, you know, everything I say could be dismissed. But, luckily I do have children, and not only for that reason, I'm glad that I have them. So when I say to people, yes, I'm writing for about gender, other parents, this is, you know, a very, very common response. Oh, we tried, and yet, despite this, our children's sort of biological and gender poor, sort of defied our best efforts. And I think the issue with this interpretation, and just to be clear, I'm not saying I don't dismiss the possibility that there might be some kind of biological predispositions that do differ between the sexes. What I'm saying is that the issue with gender socialization is it sort of ignores, there are two aspects of it. So I think there are a useful way of thinking about children and their acquisition of sort of gender types of behavior is before and after children have a sense of their own, which side of the sex divide that they fall. Mm-hmm. So the fact is that children are born into a society where what sex you are is really the most important social division. So it's emphasized continually through language, through appearance, through symbols. They live in the children's media are absolutely bountiful with information about gender correlates, what goes with being male, what goes with being female, and so on and so forth. And we also have to bear in mind that parents, what they sort of consciously endorse about gender isn't really the whole story about their psychology. So what social psychologists are well aware of is that, you know, the way that we behave, the way that we perceive other people, isn't all fully explained by what we sort of consciously, explicitly report about ourselves and our beliefs and our values. And it's clear that, you know, children from the moment they're born are sort of born into an environment where, you know, a little girl is going to see a lot more pink and a lot of more certain types of toys, and a little boy is going to see a lot more blue and a lot of other types of toys, and from, you know, even from clothing, from bedding. There's a very strong sort of gendering of childhood. And so what I would say is that the actual sex differences in behaviour prior to the age of two, which is the age at which children become, you know, can say, yes, I'm a girl or I'm a boy, they're actually very subtle, and it's not clear, to me, it's not clear whether this is, we need to chalk this up to biological dispositions, or whether it could be to do with, you know, unconscious behaviour on the part of the parent, the different environments that they're growing up in, and so on and so forth. Once you get beyond the age of two, you have to understand children as having, they've grown up in a society where they understand that, you know, gender is a terribly important thing. They've learned a huge amount about it, and then suddenly they learn which side of this great divide they belong. And of course, they're motivated themselves to self-socialise. So it doesn't matter if mummy hates the pink tulle dress. They know perfectly well that that is pink tulle equals female. And if, you know, they know that they're female, they're going to want to wear that dress. And the fact that mum doesn't like it, dad can't stand it, shouldn't be taken as evidence that there's some sort of gendered core to the child's behaviour.
So, Cordelia, your book goes through this really damning catalogue of all the ways that people infer innate cognitive differences between the sexes when really they shouldn't. And you give plenty of examples of how children are, at a really young age, socialized into these expectations of how they should, what they should be good at and what they should prefer because of their gender, and that even triggering very subtly the awareness of their gender and making their gender more salient can cause them to fall into these roles and can cause girls to do worse on tests that are purportedly measuring something that girls don't think that girls are supposed to be good at, and so on and so forth. And even more so when people try to interpret evidence of, say, innate variability in IQ scores, and they take that, or they interpret evidence of variability in IQ scores as being innate when there's really no reason to expect it to be innate, given that by that age, boys and girls have already gone through this process of socialization that you're describing. So I guess what I'm wondering is, what is it even possible to do an experiment that would actually demonstrate an innate difference? Is there an age young enough that we can say, okay, we're safe, there hasn't been any this evidence hasn't been tainted by culture or socialization yet? And at that young age, is there anything really meaningful that we could measure that we would be interested in?
Well, I think that's a really excellent question. So one of the studies that's really been seen as a lot of importance, especially in the popular literature, I'd say, has been placed on is a study of newborns that was done in Simon Baron Cohen's laboratory. And the very idea behind this study was, let's look at sex differences before there's any possibility of socialisation. So the babies were sort of on average about a day and a half old. So, you know, there's relatively, you know, very little socialisation that we would expect to have occurred by then. That's the idea. And what the study did was to show the infants the experimenter's face, and also separately a sort of mobile that was made up of face-like things put in a sort of random order that was sort of moving in natural motion. And the interest was, will the girls on average be more interested in the face? In other words, you know, sort of people focus, and will the boys be more interested in the mobile sort of object, mechanical motion focus? And I do go through this study and the methodology in excruciating detail in just because so much importance has been placed on it. I mean, it's completely, it's sort of now asserted as fact in popular books. You know, boys are more interested in looking at things and girls more interested in looking at people. It's sort of simply asserted as, you know, scientific fact. But in fact, there are a number of methodological difficulties with that particular experiment to do with the possibility of experimenter bias in terms of, you know, the experiment, when the experimenter is herself a stimulus, that creates difficulties in terms of whether she's unconsciously affecting the results, and that wasn't controlled for in an adequate way, and so on.
She was holding the mobile, right? She was holding the mobile,
and she was also and we know that babies are sensitive to motion and eye gaze and so on and so forth. So, you know, there are ways in which, completely inadvertently, she could have influenced the results. But the question is, well, say we did that experiment better, and say we did or still find the subtle sex differences that they did find that were consistent with the idea of the girls being relatively more interested in the face than the mobile. Well, what would that actually mean? So one of the assumptions that was made in that experiment was that the preference that the newborn has is somehow indicative of their sort of their future as an empathizer or a systemizer. Mm-hmm. And that was really, that assumption was unargued for, and you know, there's no evidence to support or contradict that. But, you know, presumably one I suppose could find, try and look to see whether there was a relationship between the two. But I think what we need to think about if we're looking at, for example, looking at newborns as a way of trying to look at, well, what is there some sort of innate difference between the sexes, is I think in this study and of some of the research in this area, there's an implicit conception of development, which is that the developmental path is to some extent already encoded. Mm-hmm. And of course experience can push you one way or to one side or the other, but that developmental path in a sense is already in there. Whereas to me a better way of thinking about development and developmental biology is this notion that the developmental path, it isn't in there, but it's constructed sort of step by step through the continuous interaction throughout the individual's lifetime, this interaction between their genes and their environment and their experience and so on and so forth. So even if we were to see a difference, you know, at birth between sexes, we'd have to be, I think that would be an interesting thing to show, but we'd have to be careful first of all saying, well, you know, what is the relationship to this, you know, babies can't read minds, babies can't do math, so we need to think, okay, what is the relationship between this very early visual preference and these very complex socially dependent behaviours that we see many years down the track? But also, are we, when we're trying to interpret this difference, are we thinking about development in the right kind of way?
So, Cordelia, that when you were talking, a different part of your book actually came to mind that I want to ask you about it in a second. But first, about the problems, you know, the technical problems of carrying out these experiments correctly. I think you're essentially right that in human beings, this is exceedingly difficult for the variety of issues that you bring up in the book. Of course, plenty of good studies on nature and nurture have been done on, you know, non-human systems, a lot, yeah, animal systems, and of course plants. I mean, my career as a biologist was about gene-environment interactions in plants, and I'm familiar somewhat with the literature in the animal models. And one of the things that struck me several years ago is that we actually have very good evidence of how complicated the gene-environment interaction can be in rats, for instance. All the way back to the 1950s, there's this classic experiment that was done by Kuber and Zubek, I believe, at the time. And what they did, they started out with a genetically heterogeneous set of rats, and then they selected for a line that was genetically superior at finishing a maze in with a number of errors. So they called those the super intelligent line. And then they also selected for a line of really super stupid rats that were making a lot of mistakes and they were just not doing very well. So the first part of the experiment showed that, yes, you can definitely select genetically for differences in intelligence measured in this particular case, as I said, by the number of mistakes that these animals were making. But then the really interesting part of the experiments was that they then picked the same lines and they raised both of the lines, the super intelligent and the super stupid, under the same environmental conditions, which were different from those of the original experiment. The original experiment was carried out in a sort of a standard cage environment. It was repeated under two very different environments. In one case, both lines were raised in a very dull situation where there were no colors in the cage, no toys, nothing to play with. And in the second case, both lines, genetic lines, were raised in a very rich environment with a lot of colors, with a lot of toys to play with, and so on and so forth. And Cooper and Zubek showed very clearly that the clearly demonstrable genetic difference in intelligence in these animals was completely erased in both directions. That is, in the dull environment, the super intelligent animals became stupid. And in the rich environment, the allegedly dumb rats became, in fact, as intelligent, essentially statistically indistinguishable from the smart ones. Now, that to me is the quintessential way of which you should do these kind of experiments. For obvious reasons, you can't do that with human beings. Which brings me to the question about another part of your book, which is one of the things that actually struck me the most as surprising is when you show, when you discuss the experiments showing how subtle changes in the social context of adult individuals, of adult young women, for instance, actually have a surprisingly dramatic effect on the way they score on standardized tests about, you know, math, science, or whatever it is. That really surprised me, the size of that effect. You want to sort of summarize what was happening in that case?
Yeah, so these are stereotypes. Threat study. Sorry, just to come back to those fascinating experiments that you described.
Yes.
I think Paul reading that there are similar sorts of findings for aggression. Breeding aggressive rats versus mild rats, and so on and so forth. And I think those sorts of studies really bring home the point that. But there's no such thing as your real biology that can be understood as sort of separate from the environment in which that you develop as a biological system. And I think that's something that's quite easy to overlook when thinking about this debate. But to come back to the stereotype threat, so there's now. I mean, when I wrote my first book, A Mind of Its Own, I touched on this topic of stereotype threat, and that was published well. That's sort of five years ago now, and since then there's really been an explosion of research in this area. There have been two meta-analyses, which are sort of large summaries of a large number of studies all put together, that does provide pretty compelling evidence that the social context in which women perform maths, so that's one of the maths is one of the main things that's been looked at, does have an effect on how well women are able to perform. And so in a typical sort of experiment, you present the math test under either stereotype threat conditions or you disperse the stereotype threat. Now, you actually don't have to do anything to create stereotype threat, so the sort of default social environment is one in which women are very, especially university samples that they tend to use, they're very aware of the fact that there is a stereotype that women are inferior at mathematics. So all you really need to do is just present a math test. That's all you need to do. But in the contrasting position, you present exactly the same test, but you say, actually, on this test, no sex differences have ever been found. And what you're doing there is you're taking away this sort of threatening cloud for the women that if they screw up, they will just be proving that, you know, women really can't do math. And what social psychologists have been trying to work out is, well, what is it about stereotype threat that interferes with this mathematical ability? And part of it seems to be there's just this anxiety. It creates intrusive thoughts, it sort of triggers unhelpful stereotypes, it creates anxiety, and all of these have to be sort of suppressed and managed, which uses up mental resources that are actually quite helpful for doing maths as well. So it's just making it cognitively harder to do these rather difficult, do these mathematical tests. And I think what's nice about the stereotype threat studies is we have a tendency to think of our minds as being these sort of very discrete entities. But in fact, the sort of social psychologists see them as being both developing and functioning in constant interaction with the social environment. So the social environment will influence your capacity to perform at demanding math tests if it's triggering thoughts and feelings in you that will actually use up the cognitive resources that you need to actually perform that kind of test. They can also influence your motivation on the test. Obviously, ability is a very important part of how good we are at doing things, but it's also how well motivated we are to do well. So what they find with sort of more stereotypical feminine skill of understanding what other people are thinking and feeling is that if you sort of frame it as being a feminine thing, then women tend to outperform men, presumably because there's a social norm that they should do well. Whereas if you make understanding other people's thoughts and feelings something that, you know, you'll earn money for, or you might be more likely to have success with women if you're good at, then you get to sort of increase men's motivation, and actually men's performance improves, the gender gap can disappear. Or if you simply don't present it as in a gendered way, you see identical performance between men and women. So again, it's this this quite consistent picture in social psychology that it doesn't really make sense to think of a sort of spontaneous ability that we have to do, you know, math or to understand other people's thoughts and feelings, but we have to see the person's mind in the largest social context in which they're operating. And the general picture is that when you make gender stereotypes salient, even quite subtly, then you tend to see behaviour or self-perception that's more consistent with gender stereotypes. But when you push gender into the psychological background, for example, by priming people to think of themselves in a non-gendered way, oh, you know, I'm a student at an elite university, or I'm from Melbourne, then men and women's performance becomes remarkably similar, even in domains where traditionally they would perform differently.
Cordelia, that reminds me of a response that I read to your book by Simon Baron Cohen. I think it was in the November Psychologist. And he was addressing this argument you make about stereotype threat and talking about all these experiments that you describe in which people are primed in such a way as to either reduce the gender difference or to enhance it. And he says, you know, showing that a manipulation of social variables changes behavior does not prove that it was those very social variables that caused the spontaneous sex differences in the first place. So I was trying to figure out why you two seem to be interpreting the results differently. And as best as I can tell, it's that he believes that there's this sort of baseline that, like, when people aren't primed, there's no effect of socialization or culture that's influencing people's performance. Does that seem like a good characterization to you? Or why do you think that he disagrees with you about what we can infer from these types of studies?
I think Simon Baron Cohen's argument is that when social psychologists perform their manipulations and they say, oh, look, no gender differences were found in this test, or, you know, women are just as good as this, or this is a different kind of, this is a gender-neutral test, these kinds of manipulations can influence our capacity or our motivation on tasks, but that the sort of gender stereotypes and norms that are sort of thoroughly embedded and saturated in our society have absolutely no effect on our performance and behaviour. Now, to me, that's extremely implausible.
It's interesting. It seems to me that even if Cohen is right, and of course, it's really you characterize it as implausible. I don't know. It seems to me that at the very least, it's something that it would have to defend independently. You know, as Julia pointed out, mm-hmm. he's essentially starting with an assumption of a baseline, which is far from being established. But let's even give him the best possible scenario and imagine that, yeah, sure, there are in fact some differences that between in gender performances and certain behavioral characteristics that are, you know, biologically based. Fine. But then at the very least, what these experiments show is that a simple environmental manipulation essentially erases the difference, which right there cancels any argument in favor of, well, you know, the differences are biological, therefore we just have to go with them because they are impossible to overcome. Clearly, they're not impossible to overcome, even if they're there.
Yes, I think that's right. But I also think that, that there's no such thing as a sort of neutral social environment against which we can, you know, we can assess people's sort of unprimed or uninfluenced abilities. We have to recognise that people are functioning and developing in a social context that where there is very noticeable gender inequalities, there are well-known gender stereotypes, that these things are all represented in people's minds and other people's minds that were influenced by other people's beliefs about our abilities and so on and so forth. I absolutely take your point. I think that's a very important one, but at the same time, I think we shouldn't fall into the trap of thinking that there is some sort of socially neutral environment in which we can sort of assess people's sort of true biological abilities. As I say in the book, there's, you know, a socio context isn't some sort of special thing that's created in the lab of social psychologists. You know, that's the world.
Right.
We are in a socio cultural context.
So Julie and I keep having a good number of questions, so this is going to go on for a little bit longer. But before we go on, something you said a little earlier reminded me of another issue that sort of underlies all these debates. You were talking about how people conceive of development, and that in fact a lot of people think of biological development in a way that it's not really reflective of what biologists themselves know of development. A colleague of mine, Richard Lewontin, at Harvard University, who's actually done a tremendous amount of work on gene-environment interactions for decades, once he explained how gene-environment interacts and how the interaction is complex in the following way. It's a really interesting, you know, simple metaphor. He says, look, if you ask yourself how a house, say, is put together, a house that is made of bricks that are layered with the use of lime, he says, you know, you can certainly ask the question at the end, once the house has been built, well, how much weight of the house is due to the bricks and how much weight is due to the lime? And he said, you know, and that question does in fact have an answer, except that it doesn't tell you anything about how to build a house, because the whole trick is to layer the bricks and the lime in a particular sequence, without which you don't get a house, you just get a mess. And so that just measuring the number of bricks and the number of, you know, and the weight of the lime doesn't tell you anything of relevance. His analogy was with the idea that, well, can you separate in principle at least the effects of genes and the environment? And he said, well, even if you can do that, that still doesn't tell you anything, because the way in which living organisms develop, it's not by putting all the genes on one side and all the environments on the other side, and then you sort of add them up. It's in the way they're layered throughout the development. And this seems to be a very difficult concept for a lot of people to actually swallow. A lot of people really cling on this very additive, very, okay, here's the genes over here and there's the environment over there, and we just didn't need to sum them up to figure out what's going on there. Julia, you had a next question.
Yeah, well, I wanted to, while we were talking about stereotype threat, this brings me to the biggest thread on the Rationally Speaking blog in response to the teaser for this episode, which was the question of whether, until if and when the evidence comes conclusively about what degree gender differences are innate, until that point, what should our default position be in terms of just like publicly how scientists frame this issue? Should it be to assume that all the difference we observe between the sexes is the result of nurture, or should we assume that it's part nurture, part nature? In other words, does one of these positions sort of hold the burden of proof more strongly than the other? And of course, part of this question is about the consequences of believing, of holding each default hypothesis. Are the consequences of believing that that sex differences are all nurture, are those less harmful than the consequences of assuming that part of the differences are nature?
Right. Yes, well, that's really the thesis of my book is not that we should assume that there are no sex differences in biological predispositions. Really, the thesis of my book was that the evidence that's being presented as, basically, and as you get into the more popular literature, the confidence gets greater, but nonetheless, there are scientists themselves are drawing conclusions from their research that has shown that fetal testosterone influences sex type preferences or behaviours or cognition or so on and so forth. And really, the thesis of my book is actually that the actual scientific evidence for those conclusions is not as strong as it is assumed to be. So I'm not really putting forward a particular position that we should assume X until such a time, or we should assume Y until such a time, but simply saying, look, the supposed evidence for the idea that there are hardwired differences is simply not as compelling as it appears to be. But I think a useful way of thinking about this question is comes from the work of philosopher science Heather Douglas, who says, well, look, nobody wants sort of political values to interfere with the assessment of the scientific evidence itself. So the fact that we want the world to be a particular way should never count as evidence for or against a particular hypothesis. I mean, that would just completely undermine the whole point of science, obviously.
Right.
She does put the point that we can allow an indirect role for political values by saying, well, how much evidence is good enough before we come to a particular scientific judgment? So if we want to do a science experiment that shows a particular conditioner will make our hair glossier than another type of conditioner, then we might be happier with a lower standard of evidence than for something that says, yes, this pill will, prevent you from catching malaria. So the social costs of the error, because, of course, all scientific data has the potential for error. Error is built in along the way. What are the social costs of error? And then we can have a discussion about, well, what are the costs of error and how do we feel about those costs? Should our scientific judgment prove to be wrong? So I think this is a useful way of thinking about the sex difference debate. So take the neuroscience data, for example. Mm-hmm. So what you see in neuroscientific literature on sex differences in the brain is you see a lot of studies that report sex differences in the brain that will often suggest some functional implications of those sex differences, but they're based on rather small sample sizes. So very often there will be fewer than 20 men and 20 women. Mm-hmm. Now, an example of a very popular and influential long-standing idea in sex differences in the brain, which is that the male brain is more lateralized than the female brain, for example, for language. This idea that when men are processing language, they tend to just use the left hemisphere, whereas women have a tendency to use both hemispheres of the brain. Now, this was a very popular idea, and there was a neuroimaging study that was done in 1995 that one of three types of language tasks did support this idea. So they did find more bilateral activation in the female brain, but not compared to the male brain. In 2004 and 2008, Iris Sommer and her colleagues did meta-analyses of all neuroimaging studies that looked at language processing. And they, in both meta-analyses, they failed to find evidence for a sex difference in language lateralization. And actually, it's really interesting when you look at one of the figures from their meta-analysis, you just see this extraordinary variability in the results that are coming up from these neuroimaging studies. So what you see are these studies with very small sample sizes, sort of 20 men, women, and fewer, are really sort of on the fringes. And as the sample sizes get larger, they're converged towards zero, so zero effect. And really what this is showing us is that, neuroimaging data are very noisy, and these sorts of studies are not reliable. We have to be extremely cautious about any one particular study that reports a sex difference in the brain, because, especially if it's a small sample size, there's a good chance that's just going to be a spurious result, particularly given that there seems to be a tendency to test for sex differences by default, which creates a publication bias towards false positive findings. So what you have to ask yourself is, well, when someone publishes a report of a sex difference in the brain, we can ask ourselves, and that you don't have a terribly large sample size, it's not a sort of objective scientific fact that there is this sex difference in the brain that one has to be political to criticise. You're setting particular standards of scientific evidence in your scientific judgment and the conclusion that you draw that we have found a sex difference in the brain. And I think what I've tried to do in my book is to show over and over again that really the actual epistemic warrant that we have for making particular scientific claims is not as strong as the scientists appear to think. So, for example, if you find a relationship between amniotic testosterone levels and later gender type behaviour, often the actual statistical relationships that you observe aren't really consistent with the conclusions that are drawn. These neuroimaging studies are very unreliable, there are confounds, so on and so forth. So I think a lot of times the disagreement is actually the actual epistemic warrant for the claims. But I also think it would be very useful and very valuable to have a sort of open and honest conversation about, well, what do we see as being sufficient warrant for these kinds of scientific claims? Is a neuroimaging study of 10 men and 10 women adequate? Is it adequate to talk about the relationship between fetal testosterone and later gender type behaviour when you don't actually have any data to support your assumption that your measure, your proxy for fetal testosterone actually has any relationship to fetal exposure to the brain, so on and so forth. So I think it would actually be quite useful to talk about social values in this area, because I think sometimes there is a genuine disagreement about the actual empirical support for these scientific claims, but sometimes I do wonder whether the issue is actually to do with standards of evidence.
Cordelia, it's interesting that you're saying that, because we recently had a podcast on a completely separate topic with another guest, Steve Novella, where we were talking about you just referred to as the epistemic warrant of certain conclusions from scientific research. In that case, the topic was recent meta-analysis showing that a significant number, in fact, a disturbing number of medical research studies are inconclusive, precisely because of the reasons you just talked about. That is, the sample sizes tend to be very small, there is a file drawer effect, there is a selection bias effect, and so on and so forth. This is actually a general problem in science, and in particular in science that is very expensive. As you know, it's expensive to do medical research or psychological research on large numbers of subjects in a large number of environmental conditions, and some people, of course, cut corners, and we end up with a lot of studies that are, at best inconclusive, and at worst that really shouldn't really have been published. And so the problem is not specific to the debate that we're having today about gender differences, but in fact it's even more general in terms of medical research. And in fact, my experience has been that we had the same problem in areas like ecology or evolutionary biology. biology, which are other sciences, where it's difficult and expensive to carry out long-term experiments on large sort of subjects.
Well, I really like this plea for responsible use of statistics and attention to publication bias. So I'm going to take this opportunity to wrap up this section of the Rationally Speaking podcast, and we will move on now to the Rationally Speaking Pick Picks.
Welcome back. Every episode, we pick a suggestion for our listeners that has tickled our rational fancy. This time, we ask our guest, Cordelia, for her suggestions. Cordelia?
Thank you. Well, my pick would have to be a book that I've just read by someone who I've mentioned in the interview, Heather Flocker Science, Heather Douglas, who has just published a book called Science, Policy, and a Value-Free Ideal. So Douglas's book really is arguing that not only is the idea of value-free science unattainable, but it's also perhaps not even desirable. And Douglas's examples, and this includes some of the academic papers as well, she tends to focus on the natural sciences, but also I think her arguments are very relevant to the topic of sex differences. It's a really very fascinating book that really sort of is quite illuminating as to how, without realizing it, social and political values are really can be built into the internal stages of research without us even realizing it. So I think for people who are interested in the politics of this debate, and of course in science generally, this is a really fascinating and reliable book.
Well, thank you so much, Cordelia. It's been such a pleasure having you on the show today. And I would recommend your book, Delusions of Gender, to all of our listeners. It's really a pleasure to read.
Thank you.
So this concludes another episode of Rationally Speaking. Join us next time for more explorations on the borderlands between reason and nonsense.
Cool.
What is that?
Oh, it's the schedule of speakers for Nexus.
Nexus?
Yeah, it's the Northeast Conference for Science and Skepticism.
Oh, are you going?
Yeah.
Nice. Tell me, what is Nexus?
What's Nexus? Oh, well, it's an educational conference held annually in New York City. Nexus explores the intersection of science, skepticism, the media, and society for the purpose of promoting a more rational world.
How does that spell Nexus?
What?
How does that spell Nexus? It's N-E-C-S-S. Should be Nechesessa.
What?
Should be pronouncing Nechesessa. I not know English so good, but N-E-C-S-S no spell Nexus.
Well, okay, yeah, but
Nechesessa. What's wrong with Nechesessa? Nechesessa. I have brother-in-law. His name is Nechesessa.
You do?
No, but I could. Nechesessa. It rolls off the tongue.
Your tongue, maybe.
What?
Nothing.
So who is speaker going to be at Nechesessa?
Nexus.
Whatever. Telling me who.
Well, scheduled to appear are Brooke Allen,
Jay Novella,
Evan Bernstein,
Steve Novella,
Hal Bidla,
John Allen Powell,
Julia Galef,
Massimo Pigliucci,
Dan Gardner,
John Rennie,
Thomas Gilovich,
Todd Robbins,
Jennifer Michael Hecht,
Eugenia C. Scott,
George Hrob,
Rebecca Watson,
Daniel Kahneman,
Carl Zimmer,
Bob Novella,
and keynote speaker Phil Plate.
Ooh, is Death from the Space Man.
Death from the Skies, right.
Listen, how you do that?
Do what?
Make your voice all bouncy, bouncy like that.
Well, I am a podcaster.
Ooh, it's very nice. Tell me, what is podcasting?
Nexus.
Nexus.
Shh. The Northeast Conference for Science and Skepticism, April 9th and 10th in New York City. Go to nexuscon.org or check out our Facebook page and Twitter feed.
The Rationally Speaking podcast is presented by New York City Skeptics. For program notes, links, and to get involved in an online conversation about this and other episodes, please visit rationallyspeakingpodcast.org. This podcast is produced by Benny Pollack and recorded in the heart of Greenwich Village, New York. Our theme, Truth, by Todd Rundgren, is used by permission. Thank you for listening.